Today I will be talking about mass-gap topological molecules and large and volume independence. This is work done jointly, mostly jointly with Larry Yaffe. Almost more or less everything I did on large and volume independence is with him, and more recently with Eric Popitz on mostly gauge dynamics on compactified geometry. So my talk is essentially about non-perturbative gauge dynamics, things that we would like to understand in generic gauge theories, typical gauge theories in four dimensions. The questions such as the existence of a mass gap, whether it exists or not, and in either case, why and how. A closely and intimately related question is about confinement. And we can continue this list, symmetry breaking, conformality comes about, and it goes perhaps more towards more complicated. And most of these problems are quite difficult to address in a general gauge theory. But it is quite relevant because part of the nature is strongly coupled non-abelian gauge theory, and we would like to have a better understanding. First, let me just state a few simple facts about perturbation theory versus non-perturbative physics. Let us consider a gauge theory with coupling G. And in almost all the gauge theories that we understand, some of these non-perturbative phenomena, they appear as exponential minus 1 over g square effects. So I just want to take you back to your undergraduate years, classification of singularities in complex analysis, and remember the type of singularities. They were classified in three: removable, false, and essential singularities. The first two are good, the essential was bad. And if you look to this expression, exponential minus 1 over g square, it has an essential singularity at g equals 0. Hence, in some sense, cannot appear at any order in perturbation theory. And so this is to say, if you happen to extend this function around 0, you will get 0 plus 0 plus 0. So even at infinite order in perturbation theory, we will not be able to capture to such effects. So loosely speaking, or morally speaking, there is some rationale for thinking gauge theory is a theory with two expansion parameters, g squared and exponential minus 1 over g squared. Obviously, these are related. Many people taught us that these two notions are related in much simpler context, for example, in quantum mechanics. In quantum field theory, it's more difficult. And the question I would like to pose is that whether one can expand, understand systematically exponential minus 1 over g square effects in some corners of gauge theory. And there are some new tools to study these things. And let me just state the tools, then I will give you the outline. I put new in quotes because some of them are not really new, quite old, but they have some new and interesting twists. One thing I will talk about is circle compactification with periodic boundary condition for fermions, and this is something quite common in supersymmetric gauge theory. That's the boundary condition that we would use to preserve supersymmetry, but it turns out to be extremely useful in non-supersymmetric gauge theory, much more than we could have anticipated. There is a second thing, large and volume independence. And this was a very hot subject in the mid-80s, and one of the experts, actually, Isaac, is in the audience, and I'm very pleased that he's there. But it didn't work. It didn't go anywhere. And there are some interesting progress about it, and it's also both analytically and numerically a useful tool. And finally, there is something called tensor-stabilizing double trace deformations, which I will describe. Now, I will argue that these tools apply usefully to typical gauge theory. This is at least graded according to the supersymmetry of the gauge theory. We have at n equals 0 pure Yang-Mills, QCD-like theories where fermions appears in left-right symmetric pairs, and chiral gauge theories in which only left-handed fermion appears. There are n equal 1 theories, supersymmetric Yang-Mills theories, using QCD and supersymmetric chiral theories, and there are other theories too. But the tool that I will describe is typically useful in any of these theories. Now, let me give you an outline and apologize a little bit, because most of the things I will tell you are the things that I did in 2007 and 2008, and it will be somehow repetition for Freddy, who heard my talk earlier, but I thought since this is a more general audience, I try to give some overview of conceptual progress, main progress. This said, you know, if you want to talk about more technicalities, I will be very happy to do so. So the outline is, I will first tell you what large N volume dependence is, and I will tell you what large N volume independence is. And there are some quite nice progress here. Then I will tell you about zero temperature compactifications and theories without phase transitions, which is a good thing if you want to extrapolate dynamics as a function of radius. I will give two examples. Second one is time permitting. If I cannot go there, I will skip it. But the first one, I will demonstrate the existence of mass gap in a vector-like example on R3 cross S1. Here, S1 is a spatial circle, not a thermal circle. And the example I chose is QCD adjoint because it happens to be the simplest example. And there is a second example I will mention. It is, for example, a chiral supersymmetric gauge theory, a very exotic supersymmetric gauge theory. This example appeared in the context of dynamical supersymmetry breaking. In the past, people assumed that it confines and it has gapped gauge fluctuations. But I will prove that it doesn't have mass gap, so it doesn't confine. This part is slightly more technical, it relies on the same philosophies that I brought to you in the previous page. I just chose two as distinct as possible gauge theory examples to show the wide range of applicability of these some of these methods. And I think I already made this disclaimer, so it's really a broad brush overview. Some people like more technical talks, with more. Details, but I think that would be slightly less useful. And my apologies again to the people who likes this kind of talks. Now, I want to start with, let me also say that please interrupt wherever and whenever something is not clear. All questions are welcome. Let me start with the main idea. The main theme is using, start with four-dimensional space. This is the target theory that we would like to work with. And compactify it on circle or tori in various dimensions. And the main idea is about inferring the properties of the infinite volume theory by studying arbitrarily small volume dynamics, or small volume dynamics, not arbitrarily small. And the characteristic size is L. I will denote it L. So there are two questions that I would like to mainly address. One is, whether we can use compactification as an expansion parameter to study non-perturbative dynamics, because I will address asymptotically free theories, hence at small circle by asymptotic freedom, the theories will be weakly coupled. The other question is, which is a much more ambitious question actually, can we use small volume theory to describe infinite volume theory in its totality? This of course sounds very weird because of obvious reasons, which I will momentarily describe. And let me start with an example which is really something freshman level. Let me tell you what volume dependence is. Consider, for example, a point charge on three-dimensional space. By Gauss's law, it has the potential 1 over r. Now, let us compactify one of the space dimensions, right, on a circle with size L. Space is r2 times s1 now. It's locally still three-dimensional. And if you look to the field of this point charge, at short distances, it is still 1 over r. And at long distances, if you just use method of images, you will think that this is a uniform, at asymptotically large distances, a uniform line of charge, and it has potential logarithm r, which is the solution of Gauss's law in two dimensions. Now, the characteristic length scale, which enters to this problem, where potential changes from 1 over r to log r is reduced, L. And this is very intuitive. You can compactify more dimensions, go from 3D to 2D log r, and in one dimension it is absolute value of r, essentially potential of a plate, and this is Gauss's law in different dimensions, whereas volume independence demands something drastically different. It demands that the interaction between two charges, take them, the interaction between them should remain 1 over r as you continue to shrink the space. That sounds completely absurd. It is absolutely wrong in Yuvan gauge theory, right, where our intuition lies upon. But in large N gauge theories, if certain conditions are satisfied, not only this is true, but a host of, this is a perturbative observable in this case, a host of non-perturbative stuff are also true. So let me give you the statement of large and volume independence. And this is also called Eguchi-Kawai reduction and large N reduction. In the modern literature, it's called large and volume independence, which is slightly more insightful as a name. And it is something quite rare in quantum field theory. It's really a theorem in lattice regularized gauge theories. And the theorem is following. Consider an SUN gauge theory. This SUN can be arbitrary the group, actually, which has a large N limit. On toroidal compactification of four manifolds, of R4 down to some four manifolds, toroidal. And it turns out there is no volume dependence in leading large N behavior of topologically trivial single trace observables. These are Wilson loops. As well as their connected correlators, provided there are no phase transition as the volume of the space is shrunk. From the first one, you can extract, for example, things like string tension in gauge theory. From the connected correlator, you can extract mass spectra of the theory, non-perturbative mass spectrum. Although this statement is true, more technically, I should have said there is no spontaneous breaking of center symmetry and translation symmetry. I will define these, but for the moment, you can just keep in mind that there shouldn't be any phase transitions as the space is shrunk. And there are two proofs of this. One of them is comparison of large N loop equations given by Eguchi and Kawai, and the other from large N classical dynamics by Yaffe. The first one is quite technical. The second one is more technical. Maybe you don't want to hear neither in a talk. Maybe I will give a more intuitive description, which also easily translates to D-brains. This is a theorem, but there was only one problem with it, actually. In any example that people studied in gauge theories, the problem was nobody was able to find an example in which this provided part holds. So as you take a four-dimensional gauge theory, as you shrink the volume, there's always some phase transition. But apart from, but one may ask the following question. Why should really anybody care about this? Why people cared so much in the early 80s? The idea is following. We can write a quantum field theory in Hamiltonian formulation on R3 in four-dimensional space, the three-dimensional space and time, continuous time, real time, and we can reduce it to quantum mechanics by reducing the space to a point, for example, in a lattice regularized theory. And the promise is following. If one finds the spectrum of the theory on R3, it would be the same thing as the spectrum of the theory of quantum mechanics, where this is really a quantum mechanics of large matrices. This is the promise, so perhaps we can understand quantum mechanics easier. And most of us would like to think, or we pretend that we understand quantum mechanics slightly better than quantum field theory. That is one possibility. If it is so, it is nice. Then we can have we can go further and learn some things about quantum field theory. But perhaps more importantly, it may also give us a new way to think about quantum field theory itself. Now, let me tell you basic intuition behind volume independence in perturbation theory. This is, if you consider, for example, in infinite space, momenta is continuous. It forms a continuum but if you compactify the space in one dimension, for example, if you take particle in a circle, the momenta is discrete and it is quantized in units of 2 pi over L. It turns out, I will show this later pictorially, it turns out on a circle with size L, if this provided condition holds, the spectrum is still discrete, but it is much finer. The spectrum turns out to be 2 pi over L times N. So how do we take the compactification limits? Well, here is some discrete spectrum. What we do generally, we take L to infinity, and then all these states come down, form a continuum, and it becomes a four-dimensional theory. There is something interesting about second condition, second case. We can take a continuum limit by keeping L fixed and taking N to infinity. You see, the space is fixed, and you are just increasing N, and the in perturbation theory, the states in perturbation theory form a continuum. There is, when they form a continuum, there is really no reference to the compactification scale L. So L can be in lattice units 1. As long as you take N to infinity, you have a space with, it looks like you have a space with characteristic size N times L. So in this sense, for example, if we go back to our simple example of point charge, the change in the potential from 1 over r behavior to the log r behavior still takes place in the second theory, but the characteristic size at which it takes place is n times L. And at any L, at any finite L, as you take nc to infinity, this scale diverges. Theory never loses its higher dimensional character, although you reduce the space to a much smaller size. So this is good. This sounds interesting. But let me tell you now what was the stumbling block in the past. Obviously, because of this attractiveness of the idea, this received a lot of interest in the mid-80s. However, when people try to shrink the space, there was always a phase transition. This is the sort of phase continuously connected to R4, and which is confined phase, and perhaps this is the deconfined phase in a confining H theory, and there is an instability here. Technically, what happens, I will show this in detail, technically what happens is that people do an effective potential calculation in terms of Wilson lines. This is used to determine the phase of the small volume theory. And this always gave a negative sign for all gauge theories, and we needed a positive sign. And people essentially gave up this idea. There were some cures, but they were later proven to be wrong. So this is the situation. There is some instability, and we want stability. And many good field theorists worked on this problem, actually, in the early 80s, you know, including David Gross, Migdal, Kazakov, Parisi, and others. I see Isaac Fars is not there, but he also did some very nice work. My apologies. It's an incomplete list. There are really a lot of papers on the subject, but the conclusion was really best described in terms of this picture. Didn't go anywhere, really. This picture, I can tell this, I think I stole from my advisor, David Kaplan. He used this in the context of lattice supersymmetry. That was a field where this situation was decidedly so in the early 80s, but the field underwent a small size revolution starting with 2002, David and I worked a lot on that. But technically, let me tell you what's going on. Let us take, for example, pure Yang-Mills theory. When we compactify the theory, if you consider gauge rotations, gauge rotations can be aperiodic up to an element of the center group. This is global part of gauge symmetry. So physical color singlet observables, such as Wilson lines, are charged under this symmetry. This is Tuhut center symmetry description. And in the pure Yang-Mills theory, if size is larger than a certain critical size, the theory is in the unbroken center symmetry or confined phase in which all the moments of the Wilson line, moments of the Wilson line vanishes. If the size is lesser than a critical size, that means higher temperature, center symmetry is broken, we are in the deconfined plasma phase. And this is really the reason that Eguchi Kawai fails. You know, if you start to reduce space dimension sequentially, start with R4, R3 cross S1, then go R2 times S1 times S1, so on and so forth, even from the very beginning, you see that you have no standing chance. In the thermodynamic limit on R3 cross S1, it fails. So in this sense, this provided part from the old point of view, which always used thermal compactification, is really actually impossible. And the reason is traditionally in QCD or QCD-like theories, compactification on R3 cross S1 is only used to study the thermodynamics of the theory at finite temperature with a partition function and things like that. And if you do that, we all know that there are two phases, high temperature quark gluon plasma phase and low temperature confined phase. And this is true. This picture is true for all confining gauge theories. And this is the impasse for the volume independence as well as the stumbling block to use the reduced as an expansion parameter. There is a singularity on the way. How do you avoid this? And the resolution will be embarrassingly simple. So in 2006, I knew this when I was a grad student because we did some journal club on large and volume independence. And in 2006, I realized that the analog of that effective potential calculation in a supersymmetric gauge theory gave zero, which is interesting. This is the marginal case in my plot. And this comes from a very nice identity associated with supersymmetry. This is this identity. This is contribution in some language of gauge bosons and fermions can't wreck that. And if you want to be slightly more precise, I will be more precise, much more precise momentarily, but it was the following. In the effective loop calculation, there was minus one times stuff, which was the bad part, which generated this instability, plus one times same stuff. And the crucial point was the appearance of this plus one, but it appears, the crucial observation is that it appears not because of the supersymmetry, but because of the boundary condition one uses in order to preserve supersymmetry. So if you endow fermions with periodic boundary condition, not anti-periodic, then the sign here is plus one. Immediately, we deduce the following. All we need to do is to add few more fermions to the system. The outcome is non-supersymmetric. I will abbreviate it QCD adjoint. And we see that there is some positive thing coming out of here. And this simple calculation is really the first positive sign which comes out of this one loop, you know, very traditional Gross, Pizarsky, Yaffe type calculation. I already emphasized that all the earlier calculations were done for thermal boundary conditions. I will give some evidence that this flip of the sign may be one of the most promising avenues to study non-perturbative dynamics in gauge theories in general. So, for people who like slightly more technical things, what we are doing is essentially following. Let us take this theory, QCD with adjoint fermions on R3 cross S1 and NF nestless fermions, and endow them with periodic boundary conditions. So in operator formalism, using boundary condition means that you are still doing a trace over Hilbert space, but it is a signed sum. So you insert this factor of minus one to F, which grades bosonic versus fermionic Hilbert space differently. So, and we are all familiar with this quantity, of course, in supersymmetric theories. In supersymmetric theories, this is the celebrated supersymmetric Witten index, and it turns out to be quite useful. In non-supersymmetric theories, I will refer to this as twisted partition function because it's different from the usual partition function of the sign. And I think I feel confident saying this, that this may probably be more useful in non-supersymmetric theories. So now, if you go back and consider this one loop calculation, technically what happens is that you have this Wilson line, and when you use this twisted partition function and at small S1, if you calculate the one loop potential, it comes out to be minus one plus NF trace omega n squared. So this quantity is positive. If NF is equal to zero, as you can see, this is pure Yang-Mills case. It is negative. And if you calculate it at its minima, you will immediately get usual Stefan-Boltzmann law for n squared Guglionic degrees of freedom minus n squared t to 4. It's your usual Stefan-Boltzmann law. But in this case, this object, this one loop potential, has no thermal interpretation. It's really one loop potential for a spatial Wilson line. And apparently, with the stabilization of the center symmetry, we are in good shape. The mass square is positive, so there is stability. And this is the work that I did with Pavel Kostun and Larry Yaffe in 2007. So what does this mean for us? Is this clear? It means the following. If you take this theory, QCD with adjoint fermions, and endow with anti-periodic boundary condition, the theory will have phase transition in large M, and there is no volume independence. But if you use periodic boundary condition, the theory will go to arbitrarily small volumes, and there will be no phase transitions. And one can use small volume theory to study dynamics of large volume theory. So, and after the first year, this thing appeared. In the first 1.5 years, nothing happened actually. But later on, especially pioneered by Barak Gringold and Steve Sharp, people started to take it more seriously. I think there are now at least four or five lattice groups working on this quite seriously, simulating 1^4 or such type of lattices, quite tiny, and trying to extract infinite volume properties. I think in time, it may perhaps be more appreciated if it proves to be more useful. But apparently, this is the really first realization of the beautiful idea of Eguchi and Kawai after 25 years. And one can ask to the promise part of this correspondence, one can ask whether we can use quantum mechanics to solve four-dimensional gauge theory. Numerically, the answer is yes. No, it doesn't work. These gentlemen, Hanada, Hazeyanagi, as well as Vairin, Hose, and Tepper, show that it certainly doesn't work, because the penalty imposed by twisted boundary condition is order n, and the fluctuations are order n squared. So,
Gonzalez and other people, they still claim that it kind of
works. No. Gonzalez and Gonzalez Arroyo and Okawa have a new paper. They claim it should work, but the entropic argument is quite strong, and but it's a fair remark. But I want to emphasize something. In this question. Here, one thing, it's a matrix model in that case, and I wanted to have something which works as you shrink the space gradually. So I didn't immediately want to map the theory to a matrix model, but I wanted to have a property like this. So that kind. But if you want to study on this analytic, numerically the situation looks very nice actually. For example, with this group, I did a study of deconfinement transition. Ram Jacobi is student of Eraharoni, and these two folks are students of Kawai himself. And we did some simulations. For example, let me just mention one example, which is pretty nice. 1³ × 2 lattice. And we studied, for example, the confinement transition in Young-Mills theory. And we found the Bayer coupling where the transition happens. And if you go to the lattice literature and look to the state of the arts results by, for example, Mike Tepper, which is on quite large lattices, which has of order of 1,000 sites, the results are almost identical. I mean, the difference is less than 1%. It's for the deconfinement temperature. It's quite tantalizing. But I must also admit that the analytical attempts to make progress on this is on the way, but it seems to be quite hard. It's theory of non-commuting matrices. It's hard to deal with. This is like, in some sense, eigenvalues behave like fuzzy brains, in some sense, and it's quite difficult. Now, please.
You must have fermions, a bunch of fermions, in the joint representation. So. And if you are doing lattice computations, you have to, of course, also use those methods, the newer methods, I suppose.
Yes.
To put them on the lattice.
Actually,
so how complicated is it?
This is a nice question. Actually, people study this by using Wilson fermions, the most traditional it can be. And they studied the phase diagram in the mass as a function of the fermion mass. And this is the work of Bringholz and Sharp. Then they got the phase diagram very nicely. And this even works for quite substantially large fermion mass. You know, even if the fermion mass is of order of cutoff scale, and the theory essentially emulates pure Young-Mills theory. It is quite drastic what happens there. We have some understanding, but I will be happy to talk to you about it in more private, you know. But there are also people using overlap fermions and things like that. Massive fermions also work. I wanted to make the discussion clearer by just sticking with massless fermions, but from the lattice gauge theory's point of view, massless fermions is a big hassle, so it's a fair question. But it works with massive fermions too. But now, now motivated by this QCD adjoint, one can go back to the pure Yang-Mills theory. And there is, of course, these symmetry breaking. And Larry Yaffe and I studied this in a bit in more detail. And we reached something quite new in quantum field theory, something that I learned throughout this process. And it is the following. Of course, if we add externally a potential to the Yang-Mills on small S1, we can externally stabilize the symmetry, sure. But the surprise is this double trace deformation, apart from preventing the symmetry, apart from preventing the symmetry breaking, it has no effect on the n equal infinity center symmetric dynamics. What does it mean? It means you add this deformation, and A here is a prefactor which is order 1 as n goes to infinity. So it's not a small perturbation. It's not a perturbative statement. The deformation is order n squared, and action is also order n squared. And in quantum field theory, we typically expect that if we do a deformation of a Lagrangian by an order n squared object, we should alter dynamics drastically. But it turns out that the because of the double trace nature of this modification, these operators do not alter the observables in the theory. Maybe I should say it in a picture. This is ordinary Yang-Mills theory in confined space. When you add that deformation, there is some deformed Yang-Mills theory, and these two theories are equivalent up to order 1 over n squared corrections. The mass spectra are identical. On the other hand, the deformed theory does not have a phase transition as you shrink the space, although ordinary pure Yang-Mills theory does. And now we have these at the corners of this commutative diagram, commutative triangle, a matrix model or quantum mechanics problem, which is equivalent to pure Yang-Mills theory on R4. It is quite interesting, but I must say these double trace operators, of course, are also proposed in string theory. But I think, at least in my view, this may be one of its most important aspects, the fact that it doesn't alter symmetric dynamics in some sense, so long as the symmetry is preserved. Gabriele Veneziano, you know, pointed to me that this deformation is just like Good Samaritan. It does the good deed and sequesters itself. You don't hear about it anymore. And it is really so. It's the insightful remark, I think. I also use this word orbifold equivalence in this transparency for the volume independence. From the modern string theory point of view, this is really projection, orbifold projection by discrete symmetries of the theory. So it's really an orbifold equivalence. And Eguchi Kawai is one of the nice examples of the orbifold equivalence. Now, let me tell you a few things about scales in the problem. And I also promised that I would give you some intuition behind this volume independence by using D-brains. Because there are quite a few string theorists in the audience. In the usual case, when center is broken, eigenvalues clump. And the spectra is quantized in 1 over L. We have control in the L times Strong scale much less than 1 domain, and there is L dependence. You can think of these a bunch of attracting D brains, and there is some SUM symmetry there. And the spectrum associated with this is this one I have shown earlier. In the center symmetric case, eigenvalues repel. These are like splitted brains in some sense. And at least the spectrum is quantized in units of 1 over nL. And there is perturbative control whenever n times L times lambda is much smaller than 1. And in this regime, dynamics becomes quite tractable. You can, there are topological defects. These are, you can imagine them, these are monopole instantons or fractional instantons, or in Euclidean sense, bits of D0 strings stretching between these. And one can show confinement in the almost in the same sense as Polyakov. There is mass gap for gauge fluctuations, and I will describe it for you because most people, it's not part of textbook, so it should have been, but it's unfortunate. So this is the second case that we are interested in. So now, from now on, I assume that also, one thing I should have said, you know, if you imagine these things as D brains, of course, you immediately realize that the strings, the mass associated with these strings is separation between these D brains, and this is where this 1 over n comes from in that language. So from now on, I will take n fixed, n small. I will take n equal 2, and I will study this class of theories in which there is no phase transition. There is no phase transitions in the sense of center symmetry as you change the radius of the theory. And I should also assert that this regime where I will make some, I will report some progress about gauge dynamics is a regime complementary to the volume independence. It's not volume independence domain because we are taking L times N times lambda much smaller than 1. That means we are scaling L to be order 1 over N. And in the case of volume independence, we have to keep L fixed. So, but regardless, yes.
Sure. Something that puzzles me. You say that the trace of omega is 0.
Yes.
And you say that the masses are 1 over
NL. W will be masses, yes.
So are the masses the eigenvalues of omega?
It is essentially separation between eigenvalues. It has the separation between eigenvalues are the masses of the W bosons.
Understanding something. How does the trace sum up to zero? Are
oh,
the eigenvalues
okay.
all positive or do you get negative eigenvalues?
Eigenvalues are angle values. So we have a Wilson line, omega. Exponential I theta 1, I theta n. And this is the situation. And if you look to the covariant derivative in the fourth direction, it replaces to L4 plus I A4. Let me define A4 is the holonomy. Omega is exponential A4 L. And commutator of this with whatever is out there. So if you do Fourier transform, what happens is here you get 2 pi over L and usual Kolmogorov momentum. And on this side, you get essentially eigenvalue separation theta I minus theta j divided by L, which turns out to be, this part turns out to be I minus j divided, 2 pi I minus j divided by N. So the spectrum arises in this fashion.
So the last line, so you say you had no confinement, but now you want to make it like confinement.
You
can come back to that.
In this theory, you relate it with confinement.
Yeah, exactly.
Of confinement.
Exactly. That's supposed to be used for exactly that theory.
Yes. We will, also in QCD joint, we relate it with confinement through a new and very exotic mechanism, actually.
Okay.
Now, a fixed and small L, it turns out we can study confinement by semi-classical methods. There are many new and surprising phenomena, and there is also a new class of topological defects, which I collectively refer as topological molecules. And the stuff I will tell you from now on is essentially, most of it is in my paper from 2007, Solution of this Theory. But before I go there, I would like to very briefly remind Polyakov's mechanism in 3D, the essence of mass capping Polyakov mechanism in 3D. So this theory, it's a Young-Mills adjoint tick system, which has two Polyakov monopole solutions. These are really instantons, finite action configurations in 3D, in this it's called Georgi-Glashow model. And Polyakov's crucial observation is following. Partition function of gauge theory in the system maps to the classical grand canonical ensemble of a plasma. That's the crucial observation. But we know how plasmas behave from the work of Debye and Hückel from the earlier part of the century, previous century. What we know is that if we insert an external charge to a plasma, its field, instead of decaying like 1 over R, it will decay by Yukawa. C here is the correlation length or inverse mass gap. So in Polyakov's language, there are monopole instantons, and they proliferate in the vacuum, and they generate a mass gap through this Debye mechanism. And this finite magnetic screening length is essentially mass gap for gauge fluctuation. This also incidentally implies confining flux tubes and linearly growing potential, but I will not go that direction. It's an equivalent statement. Slightly more technically, in 2+1, photon has only 1 degree of freedom, 1 polarization. So we can dualize it to a scalar. We can write Maxwell's term as a scalar field theory. And the proliferation of monopole instantons generates these monopole operators in Lagrangian. This is somehow imprecise terminology. I should really, instead of monopole operators, should say contribution of instantons amplitude to the effective Lagrangian, but it's a bit longer terminology. So, and I will just refer to this as monopole operator. And please keep this in mind. Sigma is the dual photon, and this is the monopole operator. And if you just expand cosine potential to quadratic order, you immediately see that the system has a mass gap, which is exponential of S0, and S0 is 1 over G squared, essentially, or 8 pi squared divided by G squared. So this is Polyakov's mechanism. Now, what happens in theories with massless fermions? Let's say we are on R3 cross S1, and we consider QCD with adjoint fermion. Let me take SU2, and let me take Q flavors, okay? So what happens is interesting. First, monopole operators have a different form because there are fermions, there are also fermionic zero modes attached to them. And there are a number of them. Hence, unlike Polyakov's mechanism where monopole induce a mass gap, in this theory, they can no longer induce a mass gap. The thing they do is interaction of dual photon with bunch of fermions. So one can ask two interesting questions. One is, how many zero modes are there? And since these objects do not lead to confinement or mass gap, is there a new mechanism of confinement? Now, regarding first question, we were somehow lucky because we need an index theorem for the Dirac operator on S1 times R3. And luckily, in 2000, two mathematicians addressed this problem. And here is the last formula in their paper. Here is the Dirac operator on R3 cross S1. And there is an index associated with it. And the first part is related to topological charge density. And the second part is because it is a manifold with a boundary, R3 cross S1, there is a boundary manifold, which is S1. Then there is an eta invariant associated with that asymmetry, spectral asymmetry of the Dirac operator associated with that boundary operator. But in that paper, it's a beautiful paper by Nyan Singer. This Singer is student of Penrose, not the other Singer. It's a quite nice paper. It's a bit difficult to read, but it's not clear where this is coming from, so on and so forth. And, you know, by following the tradition of translating mathematics to physics, Eric Popitz and I started to look to this problem. And we derived this by just starting, by just using quantum field theory, starting with exact operator identities on R3 cross S1, which is actually axial current non-conservation, and follow through the methods which are used earlier by Eric Weinberg. We obtained the same formula, but we also obtained some numbers, 2, 4, 6, whatnot. So this index theorem is quite crucial. And the result also nicely interpolates between, for example, a similar index theorem by Kallias on R3 to usual well-known Atiyah Padotti Singer index theorem on R4. If you do that, you get the following. This is NF equal to QCD adjoint. And we have, but the picture is not for NF equal to, I'm sorry. We have magnetic monopoles, these are 3D instantons, and there is a twisted 3D instanton. And they have two quantum numbers, one magnetic charge, the other is topological charge. This twisted 3D instanton is something pertinent to compact theories. In essence, you know, if you think these as monopoles going from here to there, in a non-compact space, the analog of this final one wouldn't exist. But in a compact space, there is something called KK monopole. This is some, again, not so good terminology, but it's really a twisted 3D instanton. It's a twisted embedding of an instanton on R3 cross S1. So there are two objects in SU2. One of them is magnetic charge 1, topological charge 1/2. It has 4 zero modes. The other has magnetic charge minus 1, topological charge 1/2. If you add them up, you have magnetic charge 0, topological charge 1, which is the usual BPSD instanton. And you get 8 zero modes, which is the Tu-Hoft vertex in four dimension. In some sense, Tu-Hoft instanton fractionalize in this geometry to two monopole instantons. Now, I said Tu-Hoft instanton has 8 zero modes. That means the quantum theory has an exact Z8 symmetry, discrete chiral symmetry. And the action of that Z8 symmetry on this determinant is negation. But we know that Z8 is an exact symmetry of the theory. Hence, in order this monopole operator to be invariant, sigma must shift by pi. So there is a sigma goes to sigma plus pi symmetry. And sigma goes to sigma plus pi. And clearly, this symmetry forbids an operator like cosine sigma, which would be the leading operator in the Polyakov mechanism, which generates a mass gap for gauge fluctuations. But it permits an operator like cosine 2 sigma. So index theorem, duality, and symmetry tells us that the first purely bosonic object that we can write down in this theory is cosine 2 sigma. And this is the first object which may generate a mass gap in this theory. And you can ask, what is the topological defect which may be responsible for this? If you just look to the quantum numbers, you see that this object has magnetic charge plus 2 and topological charge 0. It would be a composite of this VPS and KK bar. You know, this is just quantum numbers, working of the quantum numbers. And but you can ask the following question. How come such a molecule is possible? Because naively, the only force carrier in the system is gauge fluctuations, and both of them have plus charges. Naively, they must repel. They shouldn't form a bound state. And there is 1 over R Coulomb repulsion. So, but there is something different here. This object has chiral zero modes. BPS monopole has chiral zero modes, and KK bar has anti-chiral zero modes. If you look to the connected correlator of these two, you can extract some effective potential between these two. And it turns out exchange of the fermion zero modes generates a log R attraction in this system. And the summation of the two has a unique minimum at a size parametrically larger than monopole size. If monopole is characteristic size is L, it has fixed size. The size of the object is the size of, we refer to this object as magnetic bion because it's a composite of two topological defects. The size of bion turns out to be L over G square. It's parametrically larger than the monopole. So then in the partition function, in the pet integral representation of this theory, we reach to the conclusion that the vacuum of QCD adjoint is a plasma of this magnetic bion. There is a term which is generated by these magnetic bions, and there are fermion zero modes which are out there, and their interactions with this cosine potential. Yes. Yes, they generate. It is log R potential at leading order. Technically, when you integrate out fermions, there is a logarithm determinant term, and if you insert to that monopole, BPS monopole, and KK bar anti-monopole, you see that it generates a log R interaction. People also in the past discussed similar things in the case of instanton, anti-instanton, but I can tell you more technically what happens. So there are these stuff here, these strongly correlated pairs. Of course, they have some weird aspects. One thing is, although they have a net magnetic charge, their topological charge is identically zero. So it is, in the topological charge sense, it is indistinguishable from perturbative vacuum. Probably this is the reason that nobody tried to search for such an object in the past. Oh, I gave the argument for their stability.
Quite unique, because usually we don't have this stability. This is a dynamical stability.
It's a dynamical
stability. It's not a topological stability.
It's not topological, it's dynamical.
We have very, well, I and Rubikoff once invented a technical baryonic stability, but nobody believed in it, exactly because of the argument that, look, the only thing this ensures you, because you don't know the dynamics anyway, is topology. But here you're now saying that you're so sure that there's no other dynamical effects which can wash this out.
There is no doubt that this is,
for example, even if you take n equal 1 superpotential, n equal 1 theory with superpotential, and if you write down bosonic potential that comes out of it, and in n equal 1, we certainly believe it is true, and if you write the bosonic potential has an interpretation, this is the operator in the bosonic potential in n equal 1 super Yang-Mills theory. You know, it is generated, and it is there by dynamical reasons. I can give you a more complete argument if you wish afterwards. This is supposed to be pictorial, but this is stable and absolutely there. There is no doubt. Actually, I think I ran out of time, almost I have. I see maybe 2-3 minutes or something like that. The other, maybe I can state the results on this theory very quickly instead of telling you the details. One can go to a chiral theory to see the utility of these methods. There is an SU2 chiral theory with 3-index symmetric representation fermions. This is studied in 94 by Kenin Trilligator, Schenker, and Seiberg, and as a proposal for dynamical supersymmetry breaking. Their observation was following. If this theory confines at the origin of moduli space, one can break supersymmetry very simply by just adding an operator. Maybe I should define my notation. Q is the nether multiplet here, scalar part of the nether multiplet, as well as the name of the nether multiplet. And simplest gauge invariant that you can write down is Q to 4. Q square is identically zero. This is the reason the theory is chiral. And they realized that if one writes down such a potential, then it leads to supersymmetry breaking. And they provided some compelling argument, because if you just consider this U as the single nestless composite operator, it turns out that two Hooft anomalies of the microscopic theory are saturated by the two Hooft anomalies of this fermion here. Very good. So then this is the reason that this paper suggested that perhaps this may be confining. They also considered conformal possibility, that the theory may be conformal at the origin of moduli space. But because of the two-Hooft anomaly matching, they said most likely it should be confining. But they didn't assert that it must be confining. But we can ask whether, and the difficulty with this theory is it doesn't have any controllable deformation apart from this circle deformation that I just mentioned. And it turns out one can study very carefully the monopole operators in the system at small s1, the indices, so on and so forth. And it turns out the U1R symmetry of the supersymmetric theory transmutes as a continuous symmetry of the dual photon. So there is a continuous symmetry which prevents you from writing a mass term for the dual photon. So, but more systematically, what happens is following. If you start with R3, you can study this theory on R3, and there is a permitted superpotential in principle. But you can, one should always ask whether it is there or not. And I am going through this part quickly. I apologize, but I am just telling the main things. Technicality, I can tell you later. And by, if you look to the topological defects, you see that this potential somehow needs to be there. And if you calculate, you see that Coulomb branch is not lifted. But there is a subtlety here, and the subtlety is following. There is no region in the moduli space where both this Y field, which is pertinent monopole operator essentially, supersymmetric monopole operator, and U are both lights. On the Higgs branch, H multiplet is heavy. On the Coulomb branch, this U multiplet is heavy. And you can ask, how about the origin, whether this can be, these two fields can be a good description at the origin. And if you study two-Hooft anomalies, two-Hooft parity anomalies at the origin, they don't match. So you immediately realize that there is no description in terms of these confined or macroscopic Y and U fields. So most likely, at the origin, there is a strongly coupled CFT. This is what this is suggesting. If you go from R3, if you go to R3 cross S1, there is a second topological defect, but it has too many zero modes to create anything interesting. So you deduce that the superpotential on R3 cross S1 is identical to zero. There is a Higgs branch, there is a Coulomb branch. And we show that there is no mass gap, right? There is most likely CFT behavior. And there is this common law in supersymmetric theories with supersymmetric preserving boundary conditions. It is usually believed that there are no phase transitions as U vary supersymmetric parameters. This is not a theorem, but it is often asserted in literature, because in holomorphy, even if the coupling is holomorphic, even if there are singularities, they are of codimension one in complex language or codimension two in real language, so one can move around them. So we show that the theory on small S1 is CFT, so there seems to be, and this suggests that it should be a CFT on large S1 as well as R4. So this is, but I can tell you about the details of this theory later. So that means there is no mass gap for gauge fluctuations and no supersymmetry breaking in this old ISS model. There are some other diagnostic, and they also support this CFT argument, one by Kenintrigator and the other by Vartanov, much more recent. And I won't use this part. I will just skip it. The previous transparency is where essentially the chiral, the non-supersymmetric version of this chiral theory actually confines on R3 cross S1. But for the sake of time, let me state the conclusions and prospects. So now there are some new ways to study non-perturbative aspects of four-dimensional gauge theories by using the circle compactification as opposed to the thermal compactification. These large and volume independence, as well as the semi-classical shadow of it, provide some very new insights. One can study large class of gauge theories. And these are useful both numerically and analytically. These are also useful both supersymmetric and non-supersymmetric theories, I must say. Now, perhaps the most important thing that we have learned is that the existence of these topological molecules, new mechanisms of confinement, they can get quite exotic. And it depends on the representation of fermions, really, and mechanism for mass gap, at least in a regime where we think we understand gauge theory. These magnetic bions turns out to be responsible for confinement in a small circle for many gauge theories. One most outstanding question in this context is that whether we can extend any of this wisdom to large S1 and stronger coupling, as well as R4. This question is extremely difficult for non-supersymmetric theory. But in the case of Seiberg-Witten theory, this is a joint work with Eric Poppitz, we were able to relate the topological defect that we see at small S1, these instantons and their towers, to, you know, the ionic tower of monopoles particles now on four dimensions. There's a quite beautiful and elegant duality there. And this should appear quite soon, actually. And finally, there may also be applications to finite temperature and relativistic Kvaerion collision physics. And there are also some other interesting new gauge phenomena if we study these theories more generally. This is some ongoing work with Philip Argyres, and we happen to see some new gauge theory phenomena here, which is quite interesting. And I hope that this is a hope, optimistic thinking, that it may, some of these things may have some relevance to the electro weak symmetry breaking problem and perhaps beyond the standard model physics. So thank you very much for your attention.
Maybe I missed it. When the fermions are in non-adjoint representations, like fundamental representations, what is the story?
Oh, you see, since the nice thing about adjoint representation, gauge fluctuations are also in adjoint representation, so they can undo their effects if you use the right period, the right boundary condition. For general complex representation, fundamental or anti-symmetric or symmetric, regardless of what boundary condition you use, there's always phase transition. So in some sense, these are zero temperature phase transition, quantum phase transitions, non-thermal, completely driven by quantum fluctuations. But in some sense, in those theories, for example, in QCD fundamental, we are obliged to use this deformation idea in one way or another if we want to benefit from this.
What if you take the Veneziano limit?
With Veneziano limit,
a very large number of
it's a tricky limit because there may be some subtlety with volume independence. But we can talk about that more privately. It's a subtle question. Maybe in real time I may have problems. But in Veneziano limit, naively, it shouldn't work. Volume independence, but an equally good large N limit is what's called orientable large N limit of Armoni Shiffman and Veneziano, where you use anti-symmetric fermions, and that's also equally good description. And in that limit, with this deformation, this idea works, volume independence idea works, you can reduce quantum mechanics.
So in this double trace deformation. So you made very strong claims. So what is the status of that now? Has it been used to develop the numerical calculation?
You see, first, I must admit something. Whatever I do, it takes at least 1.5 years for a lattice case theorist to appreciate it, and or any other person in that regard. It had a slow start, but now there are people who are doing coding incorporating this double trace deformation. There was some papers recently about the simulations with double trace deformation. It seems to be working as desired. And there is also some very nice ongoing project by a lattice cage theorist, Massimo Delia, from Italy, and one of his students is working on that. But it's a pretty new idea, and 2008 is new in some sense, and it takes some time to make use of it, I think.
There are lots of questions. Let's try to get that.